just mention a few more things about regular QCD and then apply these to a new way to do electric symmetry breaking with Ida Higgs. And I'll explain more when I get there. But so our story, though, is we know the theory of QCD very well above lambda QCD. We have effectively a perturbative field theory, and we know how to compute in that. Below the lambda QCD, we don't know how to compute analytically, but we've done the best we can in a sense that we've written a low energy effective theory that seems to capture the light degrees of freedom. And we see very explicitly this is an effective field theory and that it comes in with a built-in cutoff. We have these higher dimensional operators. It's non-renormalizable. And what we can still do to make progress, though, is match between the symmetries of the high energy theory and the symmetries we think we have or we should have in the low energy theory. And we use the symmetry structure to deduce a general form of a low energy effective Lagrangian. So this is nice. This actually works very well for pions. And what we've developed is something called chiral perturbation theory. The explicit breaking of these flavor symmetries is SC2 left cross SC2 right by, the spontaneous breaking by the quark expectation value plus the explicit breaking by the small masses is called chiral symmetry breaking. And the theory of pions we developed is called chiral perturbation theory. So there's a whole industry of people doing chiral perturbation theory. One thing it turns out to be useful for is nuclear physics, in the sense that you can think of the interactions between nucleons that bind into bigger atomic nuclei as corresponding to the exchange of pions. So there's a whole industry of people doing chiral perturbation theory where you look at interactions between nucleons attached by pions. You put them all together and you build up nuclei, and this is nuclear physics. So it's highly complicated, highly non-trivial. I'm not going to get into it, but this is the basic underlying structure for it. What I want to talk about instead today is go slightly beyond our so-called chiral perturbation theory, our theory of pions. And for this, we don't have much analytic control at all. But what we can do is look at data. And a useful piece of data for this is the experimental ratio. It's called R. And it's defined as the ratio of the cross-section for E plus E minus to hadrons relative to the cross-section of E plus E minus to muons. So for muons, we know what this is. We computed in perturbation theory. And this just comes primarily from the exchange of a photon at low energies. For this has all kinds of complicated QCD stuff. So you can think of this as E plus E minus going to a photon, and then the photon connecting to charged QCD things. And this has been measured very well in the lab. And it looks something like this. So here's one GeV. And here is 10 GeV or so. So this is the center of mass energy, the collision energy. And this is this ratio R. And what you see is that this ratio turns on. It has a very big broad peak around 770 GeV, sorry, MeV. And then it kind of does a slightly more complicated thing. There's a narrow resonance about 1 GeV. And then it kind of gets fairly smooth, a bit above 1 GeV. And then from 1 GeV up to, this is a log scale, so about 10 GeV. This thing stays fairly flat until you get to about 10 GeV, at which point there's a jump. And then on top of this, there are also some narrow spikes. So these narrow spikes are just very narrow resonances. And the structure of this, this broad resonance corresponds to something called a rho meson. So a rho meson is a vector meson. And so it's a vector meson, so it has a mu index. And it's also a 0 plus minus under this SU2V symmetry. So we say it's an isospin triplet in the same way that the pions are an isospin triplet. This narrow resonance is something called a phi. What's going on here is this plateau corresponds to beyond about this level, you can apply perturbative QCD to a reasonable approximation. So what's going on here? This is flat because this ratio at high energies just measures the number of quark degrees of freedom relative to the number of muon degrees of freedom. Or specifically, the number of quark degrees of freedom with masses lower than what I can produce. So in this region, you can use perturbative QCD, and this looks just like making up, down, strange, and charm quarks. The bump you see, the jump you see here, comes from the fact that I'm now above the bottom quark threshold, and I can also make a bottom quark. And the size of this jump corresponds to was one of the first pieces of evidence for three flavors of quark. In that, if you count this as the number of degrees of freedom, I'm not sure if did I write this down. The number of degrees of freedom is going to go like NC times the number of light flavors. And the size of this jump relative to the cross-section for muons reflects NC equals to 3. So this is a nice piece of evidence here. These spikes correspond to bound states, in this case, of charm quarks. So this is sometimes called the J psi here. And this is a fairly famous discovery. It corresponded to the first discovery of charm quarks. These are called upsilons. And they correspond to what are essentially BP bar bound states. And the main process here is E plus, E minus to a virtual photon to at the level of a QQ bar, at least in the perturbative limit. Below here, though, you're in non-perturbative limit, and this quark picture doesn't apply very well. But one thing we can see, below about 1.5 GeV, where perturbative QCD starts to make sense, the thing that dominates this shape to a large extent is this very broad rho resonance. And we can think about our theory of low-energy pions as what you get if I take my theory of low-energy pions, I should start to expect to see these additional states in my theory. Additional states in my effective theory, these additional states are fairly strongly interacting. So my life becomes a little bit more difficult. But what these heavier states are going to do will be to give me new effective pion interactions in the low energy theory. So one example of this is a so-called p to the fourth operator. And the way we typically write the p to the fourth operator is there'll be some dimensionless coefficient. I'll call it A. And we'll write f squared over lambda chi squared trace del mu, sigma dagger, del mu, sigma. So this operator still has the minimal number of sigma fields to give me something that's non-trivial. It's consistent with all the symmetries, but it differs from the operator we wrote down in that it has extra derivatives on it. And if you expand this out, one of the things it gives is a four-point interaction among pions that goes like p to the fourth over f squared lambda chi squared. And we can compare this to our previous four-point interaction that we got for the leading operator. And that leading operator interaction went like p squared over f squared from the p squared term. So this is an example of a higher dimensional operator that can come about. And our estimate, and this is how the story is usually parameterized, that we usually expect, because of this structure, lambda x is on the order of lambda x is on the mass of the row, which is the thing I'm integrating out here. So I have more about this in my notes. I don't want to go too far into it, but there is you do expect additional operators in your chiral perturbation theory from these heavier states beyond the ones I've just written down. And as part of that, you get a new mass scale. This new mass scale corresponds roughly to the row mass. And this row mass gives you these additional operators. And there's a way to connect the row mass to the essentially the effective range of the effective field theory. One last comment. If you do want to push up the range of, if you do want to try to extend your theory a little bit, there's a sense in which you can think of the row as being a vector boson corresponding to, in some sense, an imaginary gauging of an underlying flavor symmetry. But I don't want to get too far into that. But I just want to mention that this kind of low energy region we know how to deal with pretty well. This is where our pure chiral perturbation theory works very well. The really hard region to describe is kind of between here and here. Because in this region, we don't have perturbative QCD. We have these extra QCD resonances, and everything's pretty strongly interacting. So this region is kind of a mess, but you can make some progress on the lattice. And people have tried some other techniques. And then here, you apply perturbative QCD, and everything matches up well. So this falls into our general story of effective field theory, that sometimes you can do a lot. Sometimes you can't do as much as you'd like. But whatever energy you're dealing with, whatever energy scale you're dealing with, you want to use a theory that's most convenient to describe the underlying physics, and typically where your fields correspond to the physical excitations you see in your experiment. OK.
How do we estimate the mass of the row? I mean, well, of course, we can estimate from the peak, but it is not very sharp. So why the spectrum is so broad for the row?
So yes, so the row is very broad because the theory is strongly interacting. So if you think back to how to computing a decay rate for someone, when you compute a decay rate, it's going to look something like some coupling squared, where the coupling is between the initial state and the final states. You typically get something like a 1 over 4 pi. You get a factor of essentially a number of final states. And then you get a factor of the mass of the thing that's decaying. So the bigger the coupling you have, the larger the decay width. It corresponds to the wider the object. So the fact that the row is very broad, given the fact that we know it doesn't have all that many final state decay modes, the fact that the row is very broad corresponds to the fact that the theory in this region is very strongly interacting. And in fact, there's a sense in which you can define a coupling, a G row of the row to pions. But so first of all, the breadth of the row reflects the strong interaction, plus the fact it has unsuppressed decays. Essentially, its mass corresponds roughly to the you fit some physically motivated shape to the distribution, and kind of the middle point is what you call the mass.
What is the typical value of R? I mean, what is the order of magnitude?
I actually have a plot in my notes. So between here and here, it's between, let's say, 1 and 5. But but that value just corresponds to, if I look at this, and everything's dominated by photons, this is just the number of degrees of freedom of a muon. So I have essentially two spin degrees of freedom. This corresponds out here to the number of degrees of freedom of the hadrons, and at least in the perturbative QC region. Here I'm going to have NC times essentially 4 copies. And here I have NC times 5 copies. So I get a jump. That's essentially all there is to it.
Okay. Here you introduce higher like P4, LP4 to deal with the like strongly interacting region, right? But I'm not so sure how this can partially cure the problem.
Oh, no, it doesn't cure anything.
Then why do we introduce it?
Oh, because we're trying to describe, it's not a matter of curing one thing or another. I mean, you're trying to describe the physics as best you can. So this is another contribution that you'd expect in the physics with an order one coefficient, but it's physically motivated by integrating out a rho meson. So for example, I can get this cubic interaction if I, thought about integrating out a rho interacting with pairs of pions. And in this case, I get a factor of g rho, where g rho is the rho pion coupling. Here's my rho, pi pi, pi pi, pi pi, pi pi. So this kind of operator is what you get, is what you expect from integrating out the rho. But the form of this operator is still constrained by the symmetry structure. So it's still consistent with our SU2 left plus SU2 right symmetry, but there are more derivatives. And to make up for those more derivatives, we need a new dimensionful scale in the denominator. And this dimensionful scale in the denominator corresponds physically to roughly a rho mass with some unknown order one coefficient. So what you do in practice is you write down all possible operators to the extent that you need them to describe the accuracy you're interested in. And you fix the coefficients with data. So you make a finite set of measurements for a finite accuracy, and then you can make as many predictions as you want, as long as you don't push it beyond the energy region of validity. So it's still useful as an effective theory. It just breaks down explicitly as you push it to higher and higher energies. OK, so the next thing I want to move on to is I want to apply this technology to beyond the standard model, and specifically to electric symmetry breaking. So if we think about our basic QCD theory, suppose we just looked at a simplified QCD theory with no mass terms, and with no mass terms, and suppose we didn't have electric symmetry breaking either. So in fact, without electric symmetry breaking, and let's say we have no Higgs, there wouldn't be many mass terms anyhow. In this case, if we have the full standard model gauge group, the SU3 cross SU2 left cross U1y gauged, these things, these left and right quarks, will also carry, in this case, an SU2 left cross U1 gauging. So in the sense that suppose the theory of our universe, our standard model, or would-be standard model, has two kinds of quarks, an up quark and a down quark. We have the usual SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry. And we have no Higgs boson whatsoever. So from this point of view, we have our same QCD Lagrangian. And these derivatives are covariant with respect to SU3 color. But with unbroken SU2 left cross U1y, we should also make sure they're covariant with respect to this part, this electroweak part of the gauge group. And well, gauging SU2 left is easy because we already have an SU2 left global symmetry. And now we're just gauging that global symmetry. So on the left-handed states, d mu QL is going to be d mu plus I G3 G mu A TA. So this is the color part we had before. And then there will be an I G2 double mu mu D TD. So, okay. So just to warn you, this is an SU3, And this is an SU2 matrix. So this thing acts on the color indices. This thing acts on the up-down indices. So so far we've been suppressing the color indices, but they're there and they've been secretly contracted. And then we also have a hypercharge plus I G prime Y B mu. So this is the story acting on the left-handed guys. And well, on the left-handed guys, we actually know the hypercharge from before. The hypercharge is just 1/6. So y on the left-handed states is just 1/6. And we can do the same thing for d mu qr. So again, we have the same d mu plus I d3 mu ta. So the color part's the same. It's a singlet under SU2 left, so there's no piece here. And then for the B mu part, the Y for the right-handed states is going to be, what's my hypercharge? The hypercharge on my right-handed states, so if I think about my up, if I think about the up states, I'm going to have 2/3. And on the downstairs, I'm going to have -1/3. So this thing is going to look like T3R plus 1/6. Yep.
So the E1 we gated by we get it by gating the E1 vector.
Sorry.
The E1 hypercharge. Do we gauge the E1 vector to get that, or?
No. So this hypercharge. I'll come back to this. But okay, the point is, I'm putting these things into a doublet.
Right.
But the things in the doublet actually transform differently under the gauge symmetry. So I'm accounting for that by putting a T3R here. So the T3R doesn't correspond to any of the gauge generators. So I should write this as a TL. This T3R doesn't correspond to any of the gauge generators because we're not gauging SU2 right. We're only gauging SU2 left. And I'll come back to how the U1V fits into this in a second. OK, but at least intuitively, if I have the upper state, the upright state, I have 1/2 plus 1/6. And that gives me 2/3. For the lower state, I have -1/2 plus 1/6. That's -1/3. So this works out. So what I'm doing here is cramming in this gauge structure into this structure, which has which seems to have the global flavor symmetry, SU2 left. OK, so let me just make a list. My gauge symmetries are SU3C cross SU2L cross U1Y. And my global symmetries are SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1V. Yes?
When we learn the center model, like we take for granted that the fundamental gauge structure is SU2L, and we don't gauge SU2R. But is there a good way to understand why we are not doing it, why we are not gauging the SU2R and just gauging the SU2L, just by experiment?
Yeah, because it doesn't agree with experiment. So if you look at the couplings of, for example, you only see left-handed neutrinos. The couplings to the W only involve left-handed states. So that's just an experimental thing. So it's within the standard model, the standard model, you give the gauge representations and the matter content, but it doesn't say why you have that content. Okay, so anyway, these are my gauge symmetries. These are my would-be global symmetries. These global symmetries are not quite fully realized in the sense that SU2 left works just fine. The U1V works just fine. But if I look at this gauging, if I look at the effect of gauging hypercharge, with a right-handed state, I've had to stick in an explicit T3R here. And that means that this piece, this hypercharge gauging, corresponds to an explicit breaking of the SU2R. So this global symmetry isn't exact. It's only approximate. But it becomes exact in the limit that G prime goes to 0. And numerically, the hypercharge gauge coupling is a little bit smaller than the others. So we're going to treat this as a decent global, approximate global symmetry, and we'll come back and worry about the explicit breaking here. OK, but in any case, this is a well-defined theory. The gauge symmetries are all happy, which they'd better be. The global symmetries are a bit less happy, but it's not so bad. OK, so in terms of this embedding, as I just said, my hypercharge corresponds to T3R plus y. Oh, sorry, T3R plus 1/6. And you can think of the 1/6 as equivalently being baryon number over 2. And just in passing, this U1V here, you can think of as corresponding to baryon number. You can also look at how electromagnetism is embedded. And you can show that electromagnetism corresponds to T3 left. Well, it corresponds to T3 left plus hypercharge in the standard model, which here this corresponds to the transformation generated by T3 left plus T3R plus 1/6. And what I mean specifically about these linear combinations is that this Y transformation corresponds to a given state. Q goes to e to the I alpha T3R plus 1/6 times 1. Right, so actually, this applies to Q left or Q right. But the thing is, acting on Q left, T3R is equal to 0. Whereas acting on Q right, T3R is just sigma 3 over 2. And similarly, for electromagnetism, this corresponds to transformations with Q left right, goes to e to the I alpha T3L plus T3R plus 1/6 Q left, Q right, where T3L and T3R are the appropriate representation matrices for either Q left or Q right. So for example, acting on Q right, T3L is 0, T3R is sigma 3 over 2. Acting on QL, this is non-zero, this is 0, and so on. So when I write these things as the generators, I mean specifically these explicit transformations, where T left and T right are defined in the appropriate ways on the corresponding Q left, Q right. So from this, I recover what I have here. Acting on Q left, this is 0, this is just 1/6. Acting on Q right, I get sigma 3 over 2 plus 1/6. So this is my story. I have these transformations, and I've taken this global symmetry structure. I've gauged this part. And now we can think and go look at what happens when QCD becomes strong. So let's assume that QCD becomes strong at lambda QCD, around 200 MeV, and look at what happens to the theory. OK, so first of all, we have Q bar right, Q left is going to be lambda QCD cubed times an identity matrix in the flavor space. And if I apply my global symmetry, under this global symmetry, this object transforms into L R dagger. So as before, we see that this vacuum condensation of the composite operator spontaneously breaks a combination of the global symmetry, or the would-be global symmetry. And in the same way as before, we have SE2 left cross SE2 right being spontaneously broken down to its SU2 V subgroup. And going back and looking at our gauging, this corresponds to a spontaneous breaking of a symmetry. And in this case, we identify the SU2 left global symmetry with the SU2 left gauge symmetry. And this means that a fraction of the SU2 left gauge symmetry is also spontaneously broken. So this corresponds to electroweak symmetry breaking. So we see explicitly that this is no longer fully realized, in that there's an explicit breaking by the vacuum structure. But we can also go and look at hypercharge. So under hypercharge transformations, this condensate doesn't care about the V part. The V part just cancels right through. For example, the 1/6 factor cancels right through, corresponding to just the rephasing. But with the T3R part, the R part would also leave the vacuum invariant. And that means that our hypercharge is also spontaneously broken. So we see that electric symmetry is broken. And this breaks both SU2 left and U1 hypercharge. But if we think about what kinds of subgroups you have of SU2V, and we go back and look at how hypercharge is embedded and electromagnetism is embedded, we see that electromagnetism corresponds to transformations with the same left and right-handed generators. So this means that a subgroup of this is U1 of electromagnetism. Because the transformations with for Q electromagnetism correspond to having the same transformation parameter for the left and right-handed pieces. We see that explicitly there. And that means that these electromagnetic transformations are a subgroup of the SU2V and U1V. So we have this as a preserved subgroup along with the U1V. And U1 electromagnetism lives within the preserved subgroup. So we see that electromagnetism is not spontaneously broken. So we can see this explicitly also by going and writing down our theory consistent with the chiral symmetries. So first of all, we know that our Lagrangian at leading order, the leading term is going to look like S²/4. Trace d mu sigma. Okay, and now to be consistent with the gate underlying gauge structure, these d mu's should now be gauge covariant. So in particular, the d mu sigma turns out to be just the usual derivative plus I G T A L W A mu sigma minus I G prime D mu sigma T3. So this piece corresponds to the gauging of SU2 left, and this has the form of an infinitesimal SU2 left transformation on sigma. So recall that under the left-right embedding, sigma goes to L sigma R dagger. And what? These Ls correspond to the SU2 left gauge transformations. So if I was to take an infinitesimal left transformation, I would see that I get this out. So this is the usual covariant gauge piece here. The same turns out to apply here. In this case, I make an R transformation, and I notice that the hypercharge lives within the R. And the hypercharge acts on the right with an opposite sign. So this gives me the extra opposite sign here, and I get T3R coming in on this direction. So this turns out to be the appropriate gauge covariant derivative applied to this sigma field for our perturbation theory. And now, when we take this, and we plug it in here and expand out, what you find is your Lagrangian is going to connect the pion fields within sigma to the W and B fields. And when you expand this out, you get F over 2 G W mu plus D mu pi minus squared W mu plus W minus plus G W mu 3 minus G prime B mu squared. So you have these terms, and then there are higher order pieces, including the usual pion kinetic terms. But we can now go and take a look at this. These pieces correspond to masses for the W boson and this particular linear combination of W mu and B mu. And in particular, what you find is a W mass of G over 2F. This thing is going to correspond to a particular linear combination of W mu and B mu. So in the same way as you do in the standard model, you write out a 2x2 mass matrix and you find its mass eigenvalues. And you find one massless state and one massive state. And the massive state is what we call the z. And the z is just g squared plus g prime squared square root over 2 times f. And then there's another massless state that we identify with a photon that corresponds to the unbroken electromagnetism subgroup. So that's what we get from these terms. These terms look a little bit funny. These terms look a little bit funny because they're bilinear. And they connect a W with derivatives of the pion fields. It turns out that these pieces are what you always get. These are the pieces that you always get that connect up Goldstone bosons to vector bosons. And what I mean by that is what you've probably done in the standard model. Remember with the Higgs gets an expectation value. You expand around it, and you expand around it in such a way that it only has one real excitation. So you choose a so-called unitary gauge. If you don't choose a unitary gauge, you find that you get couplings of this form between the imaginary part of the Higgs and the vector bosons. And they all have the form of derivative acting on a pseudoscalar connected into a vector boson bilinear. And these pieces are things that we interpret as the vector bosons eating these would-be Goldstone bosons to get masses. So the pions are the things that would be Goldstone bosons in the limit of the exact symmetry from the spontaneous symmetry breaking. And you can think about this kind of morally as a combination of a vector boson connecting into a vector boson connecting with a bilinear through a derivative coupling into a scalar. And this piece, this bilinear piece, has a form of something that looks like a mass mixing between del pi and the vector. And this piece signals precisely that these pions are now eaten by the vector bosons to make massive vectors. So these things imply so in other words, these pions, even though they're appearing here, are no longer, it depends on how you calculate, but there's a sense in which they no longer correspond to physical independent excitations of the theory. Instead, we interpret them as longitudinal modes of the vector bosons. So this looks a little bit funny, but if you go back and write down your Higgs field without making this unitary gauge choice, it turns out that this is exactly what you get. And there's a consistent way to handle them within the quantum field theory, depending on how you fix your gauge and so on. Okay, so this is actually a nice story. So far, we basically have the standard model. The only things we haven't put in the standard model are the heavier quarks. And we haven't put in the heavier quarks, and we've assumed there's no Higgs whatsoever. And we see that even if you don't have a Higgs, you get electroweak symmetry breaking, because this structure is embedded naturally. Well, the electroweak structure embeds very nicely within this global symmetry structure. This quark expectation value that you get from just strong QCD dynamics spontaneously breaks the global symmetry, which has the gauge symmetry as a subgroup of it. And from this breaking, we see that we get explicit masses of the W and Z vector bosons, a massless photon. And this pattern actually works out just like in the standard model with one problem. And the one problem is that our F scale here is 200 MeV instead of the usual V, which would be 174 GeV. So the upshot of the whole story is that electric symmetry breaking would happen in the standard model even if you didn't have a Higgs. It just would happen at a scale that's way, way too low. So this is this is kind of a neat feature that isn't always mentioned explicitly. But this doesn't work compared to what we see in experiment. But what we could do is scale the whole story up to make it work. And this is what's called Technicolor.
So, are you saying that if we somehow properly choose the gauge, like we can get rid of the all those bilinear terms? Is it what you're saying?
Yeah. So in one choice of gauge, you could get rid of those bilinears. It turns out that in this language, it's more convenient to use this. More generally, for calculations, in the standard model or other spontaneously broken gauge theories, if you want to go beyond tree level, it turns out that it's easier to keep these Goldstone mosons as explicit degrees of freedom, but bring in ghosts to cancel them off. So this is getting into more technical quantum field theory calculation. But it turns out that the unitary gauge is often very inconvenient for doing calculations beyond tree level. So in many cases, when you actually do the calculation, you have what look like either massless vectors or vectors with unphysical masses and explicit Goldstone bosons with unphysical masses, and they combine in such a way that you get the same answer you would get in the unitary gauge, but it's easier to calculate.
How do we justify that the pions are actually massive? I mean, we introduced the mass of pion by our hand like yesterday, but like this whole theory is aiming to explain the origin of mass, and we shouldn't introduce mass of pion by our hand.
Oh, but remember that the pion mass, the previous case, came from the explicit mass terms, and those ultimately come from the Higgs. In this case, if you didn't have a Higgs, you wouldn't have any mass terms for them, just because you wouldn't be able to write down anything based on gauge invariance. And in this case, you wouldn't have pions in your low energy theory either. You wouldn't have any Goldstones because they're eaten by the massive vectors. So, I haven't put any magic in. This is what the standard model would look like if I had two flavors of quarks and no Higgs.
So, in this theory, even though it is not true in our universe, like if this is true, we may not see the pion because it will kind of be eaten by the bosons. And here we are always assuming that quarks, pions are all massless. Is it right?
Yeah, well, because you can't write down a quark mass that's gauge invariant without a Higgs. So I mean, it's not a choice; it's just forced upon you. Okay, so the next thing I want to move on to is called Technicolor. So right off the bat, Technicolor in its minimal form doesn't have any kind of physical Higgs. And we know there's a physical Higgs, so we know it's going to be wrong. But this is still a useful basis for other theories where you do have new strong dynamics that's like Technicolor, but where the Higgs comes in as an explicit bound state in the low energy theory from the Technicolor dynamics. So I want to talk about Technicolor. I'll move on after that to extra dimensions, which have kind of an interesting connection with Technicolor. And then if I have time, come back and talk about this picture of a composite Higgs boson from new strong dynamics. OK, so the idea of Technicolor is that we extend the standard model with a new gauge group called G Technicolor. And for now, I'll just assume that it's some SUN TC. So this is a new gauge group beyond the standard model gauge groups. So we're adding stuff beyond the standard model. And we're going to use this new dynamics, this new Technicolor dynamics, to spontaneously break the electric symmetry in much the same way as QCD would. So now we introduce new so-called techni quarks. And these techni quarks are new things beyond the standard model. So first of all, the standard model stuff we assume is uncharged under this new group. But that we do have new so-called techni quarks that I'll write as QL and QR. Oh, I have a bit of a typo in my notes, which are UL and DL, UR and DR, which under the Technicolor group are fundamentals. OK, so these are new techni quarks. So I'm sorry about my notation. In my notation above, the big Q left, Q right were standard model quarks. Here, these are new quarks beyond the standard model things. So these are new so-called techni quarks. And these are the standard model gauge representations. So these states correspond to things with the transform under a fundamental under the new Technicolor gauge group. They're singlet under SU3 color. They're doublet under SU2 left. And they have zero hypercharge. Whereas these two objects, they're both triplets under Technicolor. They're singlet under SU3. They're singlet under SU2 left. And they have hypercharges of plus or minus 1/2. OK. Which this one, this plus or minus 1/2, you'll see corresponds identically with their eigenvalues under T3R. And that's not a that's not a mistake. In the same way that this zero corresponds to its eigenvalue under T3R, which is trivial. OK, so we take the structure. And let's assume that because this is a non-abelian gauge group, as long as the NTC is big enough compared to these number of flavors, you're going to have a strong coupling transition, much like lambda QCD. And we're going to assume, just like lambda QCD, that we have Q bar R J QL I is equal to lambda TC cubed delta IJ. So this is just like the structure we had before, but now it's a new gauge symmetry becoming strong. And we'll assume that this lambda TC is on the order of kind of order a few hundred GeV, roughly. So this structure is just like our two-flavor QCD structure, but we scaled it up. And in exactly the same way as what we had before, let me just do some counting. So here I have techni quarks. So the minimal case just has two sets of techni quarks. But I could expand this with multiple copies of this and multiple so-called flavors.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've written the techni quarks in a kind of suggestive doublet structure. And that has to do with the global SU2 symmetry.
Yeah. So the Lagrangian for this is the same. OK, I just covered it up. But the structure of the Lagrangian for this is exactly the same. It is almost exactly the same as this Lagrangian structure, which has a built-in, just by construction, SU2 left plus SU2 right global symmetry. The only difference in the theory for these states compared to this is now we don't have this 1/6 factor on the hypercharge. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. We get this story. And this is going to spontaneously break the global symmetry structure. And it also spontaneously breaks the underlying gauged subgroup, in particular the SU2 left plus U1 gauge subgroup that comes in here and here. And what we get at the end of the day is this breaks spontaneously SU2 left cross SU2 right. SU2 right goes U1V down to SU2V cross U1V. And it also breaks the gate structure, SU2 left cross U1Y down to U1 electromagnetism, which is a subgroup of this vector subgroup. So what's going on here is exactly the same as what we had above there. If we have one flavor, one copy of the structure of technique quarks, what happens is here are, here I have two flavors. And this is going to give me three broken gauge generators. And three would be Nernst-Bogolstrom bosons. So the three pions, the three pion degrees of freedom that I would get from this theory in its minimal form will be eaten to correspond to the three broken gauge generators to give the three massive vector bosons their masses. And just like we had before, we can define sigma fields. And in this case, our sigma field is just like before, 2i pi a ta. But now it has a different, now instead of having the F scale that corresponds roughly to lambda QCD, we have a new Technicolor scale, so-called pion decay constant. So this whole structure scales up. I write down my effective Lagrangian like I had before, I just covered it up. Like I had up here. And I see that I get massive W and Z vector bosons with masses given by similar expressions, but now with F replaced by F technicolor. So the idea of technicolor is I set FTC to be V. And setting FTC equals V equals 174 GeV gives me massive W and Z vector bosons at the right scale. So this is the idea of technicolor. So from this point of view, it looks very simple. It looks just like a scale-up QCD. It's nice in that we get electric symmetry breaking without a fundamental scalar and its associated fine-tuning problems. But we can also consider other variations on this. So here, these technique quarks, I only put in what's called you can say I put in two flavors. I put in an up flavor and a down flavor. But you can also consider adding more flavors. And if I was to put in more flavors with no explicit mass terms, instead of getting I still have three Nernst-Bogolstrom bosons and three broken gauge generators. But in principle, I could also have a lot more. I could have more pion fields. So with more flavors than two, I can have physical technique pions in my theory that aren't eaten by the massive vectors and that I can look for experimentally. So this is the minimal realization of technicolor, but you can also consider non-minimal realizations with NF flavors where you have a bigger global global group with, instead of two here I have two flavors. Instead, I could have a general number of NF flavors, where NF is the number of copies of the structure. I'll say 2NF and 2NF. And this would give me more Goldstone bosons. The same electric symmetry breaking structure, and a more complicated embedding. So these extra Goldstone bosons are things I can go look for in experiment. They're called technique pions.
Is all the prediction based on NTC equals 3, like 3 working gauge generators?
No, NTC just has to be greater than or equal to 2. And it could potentially be higher. I just have to make sure that the theory is asymptotically free. because otherwise I won't get a strong coupling.
Why don't we have 1/6 in this particular, I mean, when we discuss about the hypercharge, like we say we don't need 1/6.
Yeah, so this is a minimal realization. Other hyperchargers could work. But this is a minimal realization. The hypercharge would just correspond to a different charge assignment under the U1V, which factors out in the pion story. And it doesn't affect the masses. OK, so this is nice, but there are a few phenomenological problems. And let me just make a list. So we still have the standard model fermions on top of the structure. And even though this dynamics breaks the electric symmetry, it doesn't generate fermion masses. A second problem is for more than one copy of this, if you have more than one copy of this flavor structure, this so-called 2NF flavor structure, there will be more pion fields in the theory that aren't eaten as Nabokov-Goldstone bosons. And these will be massless technipions. And we don't see massless technipions. So this is an obvious challenge. The third is, at this stage, there's also a techni baryon number that's conserved. And because of the techni baryon number, on top of just these pion states in the electric symmetry breaking, just like QCD, we also expect to have baryonic states. And the baryonic states, in this case, because of the conserved techni baryon, the lightest techni baryon will be stable. And these things can be a problem for cosmology. So if they're charged, that's ruled out. If they, if you have too many of them, you get a Rayleigh density, and you might get too much dark matter. There are interesting ideas where people use things like techni baryons to be the dark matter. So this may or may not be a problem, but it's something to worry about. And this is a newer problem. There's no explicit Higgs boson. And we know that there's a Higgs boson, and it seems to be associated with electric symmetry breaking. So for all these reasons, numbers 1, 2, 3, there are ways to deal with them. And I have a few discussions in my notes as to how to fix them. The more complicated one, though, is the no Higgs boson. So this minimal technicolor picture, where the strong dynamics itself is responsible for breaking the electric symmetry, breaking the electric symmetry entirely, turns out to be not what we want. What we need instead to match up this physical Higgs boson, that seems to match up with the standard model Higgs, is instead to have a picture where instead of the technicolor, instead of this thing explicitly breaking or spontaneously breaking the electric symmetry, you would still have a strong coupling transition through new techni quarks or something similar to it, through some new technicolor gauge group. But this strong coupling, instead of breaking the electric symmetry, instead you would generate a scalar bound state. And in particular, you want to generate a scalar bound state that is relatively light with standard model quantum numbers 1, 2, 1/2, which are the quantum numbers of the standard model Higgs. So the idea here to fix number 4 is so-called composite Higgs models. And that is that our Higgs boson that we see is not an exact, a fundamental scalar, but instead it's a bound state scalar. And there are two big challenges to the story. So the first challenge is that, I'll just go through this quickly. You usually get that the mass of this new excitation, I'll call MH, is on the order of the new so-called F scale for the technicolor. which is on the order of the strong coupling scale. And the problem with this is that there's a good chance that you'll see new pion degrees of freedom at about the same energy, and we don't seem to see these additional pion degrees of freedom. So one thing we usually want with composite Higgs theories is to somehow get a separation between the physical composite Higgs mass and the mass of all the other Technicolor states, because we have very strong experimental constraints on those things. A second related challenge is if we look at the effects on the properties of this would-be Higgs boson, that's now a composite state instead of a massive state, the typical size of the corrections to the Higgs properties go like powers of the standard model VEV, 174 GeV, divided by the Technicolor scale.
What kind of Higgs properties are you talking
about? So for example, the ratio of Higgs decays into vector bosons versus quarks, or the overall couplings of the Higgs to standard model fields. So based on Higgs reaction rates and Higgs decay branching fractions, we have a pretty good handle on how the Higgs couples to the standard model. And in these composite Higgs theories, you get corrections to this by powers of V over FDC. And this should be less than, I don't know, kind of roughly 0.3 or so to agree with data. So you have these connected challenges of trying to push up the extra Technicolor states above the mass of the Higgs, plus not messing up the thing that we want to identify as a standard model-like Higgs too much compared to what we see in data. So I don't want to get too far into this at this point, but I'm just mentioning that there are very nice composite Higgs ideas that do get around this, but you have to put in some more technology. And a lot of that technology is based on constructions in extra dimensions. So the next thing I want to move on to is extra dimensions. And if I have time, I'll come back and talk about some composite Higgs models based on extra dimensional technology. So the reason extra dimensions come up is that in some limits, there's a picture where this new gauge theories with strong coupling can be matched up with theories with extra dimensions in a warped background spacetime. So this is, you may have heard of ADS-CFT. This is sort of a phenomenological application of that. So I'll wrap it up there. I guess you have a tutorial later today, and I'll be back tomorrow with extra dimensions.